That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
For 15 years, I've been trying to teach you how to write a lead. Do I have to do everything myself? Get the story? Write the story?
Listen, saphead, I could blow a better story out of my nose than you can write.
Everybody chuckles at that one. 1 week ago, rain, wind, hail battered the city, but pumped up football fans decked themselves out in blue and green to cheer on the Seattle Seahawks, including Knute Berger. Too bad there's no Team Bertha. The big tunnel boring drill is stuck underground on the waterfront still. Tom Robleski isn't stuck. He says he'll step down from his job as the head of the local Boeing Machinists Union. Meanwhile, down in Olympia, state lawmakers listened to Governor Inslee tell them to appropriate more money for schools. What are the chances of that? It is the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher with our esteemed panel of journalists assembled once again. In alphabetical order, news analyst Joni Balter, Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut Online and editor-at-large for Seattle Magazine, and Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Nice to see you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Eli, is that a blue and green blue for Seahawk thing, or are you just, is that just a...
Sure.
Okay.
Except for it's blue and red.
There's no green on it, but yeah, we'll call it that.
Well, we're going to start in Olympia. Today at the state capitol, the legislature was gaveled into session Monday. On Tuesday, the governor laid out priorities in his State of the State address.
In the coming days, I will propose a plan to make an investment of about $200 million in our schools this session. Most of that will go directly to your local school districts. It will also fund a long overdue cost of living adjustment for our educators this year.
Yeah. About 5 minutes after that speech, the Republican leadership said, nope, sorry, we're not going to do it. Eli, last week you pointed out to us that the state Supreme Court had reprimanded the legislature that they needed to make education funding a priority. And it really looks like this year we're going to have a face-off between not just the governor and the legislature, but the state Supreme Court and the legislature.
Right. And what the legislature said and what the governor interpreted, or I'm sorry, what the Supreme Court said and the way the governor interpreted is that we need billions for education over the next two bienniums, so over the next 4 years. And what Inslee is proposing is $200 million.
Yeah, right. So it's sort of like one little piece of roast beef.
Yeah. One fifth of $1 billion of what they need, if I did the math right. And so the Senate Republicans reacted to this basically by saying, no way, not likely. And Supreme Court, don't tell us what to do. And so it will be interesting to see what levers the Supreme Court pulls if the legislature doesn't come up with a plan by April, which is what they requested. The options range from holding legislators in contempt to, I guess, doing nothing. But I don't expect them to do nothing.
We talked to former state Supreme Court Justice and State Senator Phil Talmadge yesterday, who said, you know, hey, they could all be thrown in jail, or some of them could be thrown in jail, or they could be fined. And he says there's no precedent. He called it a watershed moment.
You know, I was struck by actually how small that amount was, $200 million, when the number, the required number is so high. And I was also struck by it's almost like everything Jay Inslee said, the Republican, almost Democratic Senate majority came out and said, not going to happen, not going to happen, not going to happen. And that was just, you know, I don't know if I've seen a legislature start off that divided. They can certainly get there. But
as we saw last year.
Yeah, and just stay there and keep being divided. But it was striking that most of the things that Jay Inslee said, many of the things, were stomped on within about 10 minutes.
Well, here's another of Jay Inslee's priorities in that State of the State address.
I don't have the exact number today for what our minimum wage should be. I want to work with my colleagues in the House and Senate from both parties and hear from people who depend on those jobs. It won't be a number that will remedy 50 years of income inequality, but I believe that an increase in the range of $1.50 to $2.50 an hour is a step towards closing the widening economic gap.
Okay, so that's another money issue. And he's not talking $15 an hour the way we are in Seattle. I think it was like 12 that you'd ramp up to. And then there's the third prong, transportation funding. So the governor's talking money. Knute, are you getting any sense that there's any kind of spending priority from the Republican Senate?
Well, their spending priority is no additional spending and no additional
Is that a
taxes.
Spending priority?
Now, the McCleary issue can't be resolved in a short
that, session and that's the education
in the mid-budget
funding.
Year, which is why he's recommending, a supplemental amount that would address one or two issues and not the whole, billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar McGilla. So that's been sort of pushed off. I think the problem is that on the education side is the sort of intransigence of the Senate coalition on revenues. They're in favor of increased education spending, but I want it all to come out of the existing budget, which is essentially what the Rob McKenna approach was during the campaign. So but to give you some perspective, the $200 million that Inslee is talking about for cost of living raises and other things, it's a fairly small amount in education terms. That's roughly the cost of the cost overruns on the pontoons on 520.
Right.
I mean, we're throwing money like that away right and left on all kinds of other projects. And I think people need to get a sense of proportion. $200 million investment in education is going to get you a whole lot more back than simply fixing all the mistakes that the WSDOT has made. We haven't even got to the subject.
No, we'll get to WSDOT.
Now, I just wanted to say that the minimum wage issue, I think, took some people by surprise. Inslee has not been talking about this, in advance. It's not necessarily that the state would be coming up with more money as much as it what it does to business generally and how the border counties can remain competitive with the states next door. And that's what the Republicans are talking about.
The fundamental problem is that the Senate Republicans refuse to raise revenue. And the legislature hasn't raised revenue in any meaningful way since the Great Recession hit, so since 2008. And Inslee made a very good point about this. It was either in a speech or afterward. If you are going to try to fund the required billions in education funding that you need by, slashing other services, then you're just cutting off your nose to spite your face, essentially, because you end up sending kids to school homeless, without meals, without parents who are, in their treatment programs or their job training programs. And so you make the problem worse. We've reached the point where there is nothing left to cut. You need to find revenue, but the Senate Republicans refuse.
Well, speaking of revenue, Jay Inslee did mention something that's been brought up many a time, and it usually doesn't go anywhere, and it's called closing tax loopholes. And this comes up, I'd say, every legislative session. And what happens is each of those loopholes is tied to an interest group and a lobbyist. And so it rarely happens. But that, even for this somewhat small amount, but makes sense during a short legislative session, that was going to be the method. But then, that didn't go anywhere. It rarely goes anywhere. So that's a problem right there.
Well, what makes that more difficult is the fact that the governor's aerospace industry advisor wants to increase B&O tax breaks to other people within aerospace at the same time to match to some extent what Boeing got. And so on the one hand, he's talking about closing off tax breaks here, but they're talking about adding them over here.
But he also talked about reducing the B&O tax for very small businesses.
And also for the tech industry and biotech. So they're talking about extending a tax break that currently exists. I'm not the state economist, and I'm not in charge of the budget and revenue at the state level, but it just seems like you can't cut and then give tax breaks. That adds up to negative.
That's essentially doubling your cuts.
Right.
And to give a sense of how long this has been going on, as Joni said, we've been talking about tax loopholes for a long time. But in 2011, I did a piece for The Stranger where I totaled up all the tax loopholes that the state has. And it's pretty easy to do. A lot of organizations have done it. And there's something like $6 billion a year in tax breaks or loopholes. Some of them make sense, but there's enough in there that you could find money for education if you were willing to close tax loopholes. The problem, again, comes back to Republicans who say that any closing of a loophole is actually a revenue increase. It's a new tax. And so they're flatly against it.
But why did they vote for those $8 billion in tax exemptions for Boeing?
That's lowering taxes in their mind.
Okay.
But also, it doesn't make sense.
We're talking over the week's news. That's Eli Sanders, you just heard. And then Well came from Knut Berger. Joni Balter's here, too. We're talking money at the state level. Knut, I'm sorry to so rudely interrupt you. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I just wanted to respond to something that Eli said, because the problem is difficult. I got to look this week at the state's bid to Boeing for the 77X project. And it's a 160-some page document talking about why Boeing should keep that project here. Obviously, that worked out because of the machinist vote. But in there, you can see their lists and charts of all the tax benefits Boeing gets every year from the state tallied up. And you can see how many multi-millions that is every year. But also in that document, the state of Washington was basically bragging and putting forward as an asset the fact that we do not have an income tax. They essentially have written that into the agreement with
Boeing. That we're never going to have an income tax?
Well, yes, exactly.
Well, check the last vote on that, however.
It's basically saying, and ultimately this gets us back to the problem, which is the more you give to Boeing and the more you give to these other companies, the more difficult you make tax reform and getting a more progressive tax system, however you get there. It just goes to this point about the contradictions of the budget situation that you get in.
But that's a perfect example that every one of those tax loopholes that people want to go after or are thinking of going after have either a document like that or an earlier agreement like that. And that's what makes it so hard to go after some of those.
We're talking over the week's news again with Joni Balter, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders. I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in for Steve Scher, who will be back next week, for those of you who are inquiring. It's the Week in Review on KUOW. The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. And here, as themselves, not in for anybody else, our esteemed panel of journalists, news analyst Joni Balter, associate editor at The Stranger, Eli Sanders, and Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. And before we took that break, we were talking about the legislature, and something interesting happened, which is that the ceremonial first day was more than ceremony. They actually, at least in the House, passed some bills, the DREAM Act, which was a holdover from last session.
Yeah, that's the only reason they could ever get a bill all the way ready for passage on the first day. But then this one, too, came up against the Senate, where the Senate said, you know, we're only focusing on, you know, taxes and budgets and education and basic stuff. So they started pushing back on it pretty fast.
I should just take a step back and say, for those of you who don't know what the DREAM Act is, it's an immigration reform bill that's aimed at the kids of undocumented immigrants. So either they may have been born in countries other than the U.S. or born here to undocumented immigrants.
And the legislation would give them access to financial aid for higher ed. And so that's what the House came. And there are some Republicans in the House that are for that. But again, is it going to come up in the Senate? Does it get a fair hearing there?
I asked Knut what the spending priorities were for the Republicans. So let's take spending out of that question. What are the legislative priorities for the Republicans or for the Senate majority coalition? Anybody know?
That's a very good question, and I don't think we've heard it. You know, to the DREAM Act, you can add the Reproductive Parity Act,
right,
which also has been raised, and also we're hearing from the Senate, no, not going to happen. And so you actually see a problem with the Republicans in the Washington State Legislature that is similar to the one Republicans in D.C. found themselves in, which is that what are they other than the party of no? What is the program that they are pushing here? They haven't articulated anything
Far
this legislative session except no.
Rodney Thompson said his caucus intends to stick to jobs, education, and the budget. Those are the three things they identify.
And they will say that, but they will not say how they are going to do anything about any of those things, really, because to do anything you need money, and they don't believe in raising any revenue. They are looking to cut.
Well, you'll see put forward, first of all, everybody's got their eye on the fall campaign. So they're going to push issues that are going to be good red meat issues for getting their voters turned out. On the business side, I think the Republicans do have a number of plans, and certainly individual legislators do. But one of the things is continuing to work on workers' comp and reforming that in such a way that it costs businesses less. That's seen as a competitive climate issue, and it's something that's on Boeing's wish list. Another thing that Baumgartner, the senator from Spokane, has put forward previously and may revive is right-to-work law. This is, you know, turning Washington into more like South Carolina. There are a number of those kinds of issues, looking at pensions.
Was a bill to sort of taking a page from the Boeing contract extension to make all the state workers have pensions, starting with the legislators. I think there's two different bills, non-defined benefits, in other words, 401k type plans.
Right. So there is an agenda to reduce the cost of government, to improve the business climate through less regulation or regulations that are more favorable to business. That is on the agenda. They will be pushing those forward. And, I mean, the right to work thing is, I mean, Governor Inslee, I doubt, would sign that even if it did get passed, which it won't. But it's not really about getting it passed so much as staking out your turf and being able to run, because the Senate races in particular are extremely consequential this year.
So maybe rather than the party of just no, it's the party of no and no chance bills that that you can run on.
Well, that's a slogan.
And Baumgartner also was one of the fast critics of Jay Inslee. He had said he didn't want Jay Inslee to be his state economist. And that was in reference to some of the proposals we've already talked about.
Well, you know, it's interesting to go back to the McCleary decision on education. One thing that's really fascinated me is thinking about not just divided government, but we have a system of checks and balances. That's how American democracy is structured. And when we look at it in the state level, you've got a Democratic governor, a Democrat House, a Senate that at this point is essentially a Republican Senate. Then you've got the state Supreme Court, the judicials, and they're weighing in on these issues that the legislature needs to face. And, I find it fascinating. If I had school-age kids, I'd find it worrying. But altogether, I mean, it's an interesting demonstration of how democracy can be incredibly messy.
Very messy. And that is what the Republican pushback on the Supreme Court saying you need to spend more on education was, if you want to do our jobs, why don't you run for the legislature? There's quite the pushback on that.
But the reason that the Supreme Court in this state is able to weigh in on education is that we have something that's somewhat unique. The duty to fund basic public education at a sufficient level is a paramount duty of Washington State according to the state constitution. So conservatives, libertarians, and liberals should all like this. What the Supreme Court is doing is defending the text of the Constitution, which requires legislators to do something that they are not doing. And this is where you get to a justified contempt holding, if that's what it ultimately comes to, because they are violating the Constitution of Washington State. Eight justices believe that.
But it is an interesting conundrum, because it says fully fund basic education. It doesn't say provide this many dollars as matched to the cost of living index or however economists figure things out. There's no number.
Right. But the legislature can't simply wish the Supreme Court away as much as they can try and get more Republican or conservative justices elected. Or I mean, they can influence that. But the Supreme Court's decisions are consequential. They have to be dealt with. They do provide instructions, and if anybody should know that, it should be Seattle.
I want to take a little twist, but still focused on law, because yesterday we got a long-awaited opinion from State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. He says even though Washington voters have legalized the use of recreational marijuana, cities and counties can ban pot sales and production in their jurisdictions. And we should be specific. This is his opinion. It isn't his official ruling. It's not any kind of official standing, but it is an interesting interpretation. And Allison Holcomb, who was an advocate of the pot referendum, jumped on it. Pete Holmes of the city of Seattle jumped on it. Joni, this is your purview. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, okay, so Bob Ferguson made it very clear it was a non-binding opinion and that he thought it would end up before a court. But this is very interesting if you think about it. Cities and counties opting out of legal pot. And this happened like crazy in Colorado, which is the other state that has legalized recreational pot. They have so many cities and counties have opted out. And so you have just very specific places there. Well, think about it. Remember one of the sales pitches for voting for legal recreational pot was all this revenue we were supposedly going to get, which we're not. And if more cities and counties opt out, then you have fewer entities involved in the whole system. In other words, fewer places to tax, fewer places to get revenue. So that little promise, even though it was campaign stuff, I get it, probably is limited by if Ferguson's opinion stands.
The other pitch in the new law that voters passed was that it would get rid of the black market. And you can't get rid of the black market effectively if you've got a hodgepodge of jurisdictions in Washington State, some of which don't sell pot and some of which do.
Was the decision, just clarify this for me, was the decision, I thought his opinion was they couldn't ban it outright, but they could restrict it.
Yeah, but it amounts to not having it in your
community.
Right,
right.
But
he's basically
saying
if you want to, that cities and counties in this state have the right to do that. Just, I mean, it sounds like zoning and that kind of
thing. Right, that they could use zoning to keep it out.
And that unless you explicitly take that away, then he's saying that the initiative was not complete.
The initiative did not have an important sentence, apparently, that would say that this preempts what the local governments can do. And just to give you a sense of the different kind of tools that are being used, some are banning it and some are moratorium. That's not a verb, I understand.
Moratoriuming it?
Is that what you want to say? It because it's
putting a moratorium on it.
Putting a moratorium on it so that, you know, and it's a one-year wait-and-see kind of thing. And this also happened in Colorado.
I thought the moratorium was, in fact, because they were waiting to hear what Bob Ferguson had to say.
Or to see how the whole thing rolls out. Don't forget, we don't even open a pot store here until the end of May or June because we have this, you know, seed-to-sale thing where you have to begin at the beginning in planting and having state regulations. So,
one interesting bill in the state legislature that I saw come up in response to this from a Republican was a proposal that, okay, if some jurisdictions are going to effectively ban it, then 30% of the revenue from pot sales will go back to the jurisdictions that sell it. In other words,
that's
creating...
So they don't get the money.
So that you can't free ride off of legal pot if you're a jurisdiction that doesn't sell pot. And by the same token, you create a financial incentive for people to get on board.
Can we do that with highway taxes, too?
Well, it's
see, that's
so
the problem.
Fascinating to see a Republican put this forward because that is the problem with highway taxes as well.
Well, wait a minute. What would happen? So this was an initiative, a vote of the people. But what would happen? This I couldn't help but think this. If all the other initiatives that we pass that do or don't have this sort of connection between state and local law, what if Seattle doesn't want to do a Tim Eyman initiative?
Can we opt out?
What if?
Well, when
can we zone him out of the state?
I'm not an attorney. I don't know the answer to that question. Talking over the week's news with Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knute Berger, I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. And while we're on the subject of state, let's talk about those Washington Department of Transportation projects. This week, we watched a heated war of words, I guess, between the construction contractors for the Bertha Tunnel and state Transportation Secretary Lynn Peterson, who just defended the heck out of this project.
This is the right project to get the right things done that people were asking for at the time, which was, one, to make sure that we could keep SR-99 open while under construction, and two, make the connections for freight and commuters. What we are doing right now is exactly what we ought to be doing as the strong owner, and that is getting verification that she's ready to go the full length.
That's Lynn Peterson speaking earlier this week on Cairo Radio. Now, I have been fascinated. It's been 6 or 7 weeks since Bertha's been stalled. Am I right?
Something like that.
Something
since
like
December 6th.
Yeah, early December. Yeah.
Early December. So this week they do inflate a hyperbaric chamber. They created some kind of hyperbaric bubble, and I don't know, did any of the three of you, I heard that they were going to let reporters go down there. Were any of the three of you among them?
I was not invited into the hyperbaric chamber, and I wouldn't have accepted
it. If elected for that. I haven't heard what anybody saw in that chamber.
No, there hasn't been a report yet about what is or isn't down there. And the dispute now is whether there is something down there or not.
Plus the pipe, though.
We're past the pipe.
Yeah. It's
beyond the pipe where this thing is
stopped. Right. It's pipe plus is what it is.
Yeah. Right. And so the question is, is it the digging conditions? Is it a problem with the machine? They haven't been able to find any other obstructions. So that's the question. But the interesting thing is that the problems with Bertha have leapt from underground to above ground.
Yes.
And now it's becoming a real political battle between the State Department of Transportation and the contractor. And I think that's a really fascinating thing, is that you have very heated comments being made, threats of legal action. You have a contractor that's been heavily criticized on a number of things by WSDOT, including its minority and women hiring practices. And the contractor saying, hey, I thought we were in this together. You're hanging us out to dry. You are making us look bad. And all of this is setting up. So, you know, whatever the engineering issues are now, they're big political issues.
They are. And financial.
May I just say that it's shockingly early in the process for these two to be so legalistic. This is what one of the stories pointed out, something that happens toward the end, and you figure out, okay, there's a few little cost overruns. We'll divvy them up by this legalistic talk. But these guys are starting very early about who should have known what was down there, who should have gone and gotten it. You know, quite the harsh words this early.
And some of it affects Seattle residents, we think, about, you know, whether or not we're on the hook for some of these cost overruns. But I read on Crosscut today, in fact, Knut, that there's some clause in the lengthy contract about this hyperbaric chamber, that if they're down there inflated, or whatever the verb is that you do with a hyperbaric chamber, for more than 1,440 hours, then they can start taking the cost for the inflated hyperbaric chamber out of the $200 million contingency fund.
That's right. That's
a lot of money.
There's a point. If the hyperbaric work goes on for a while, there's a point at which the contractor's not responsible for that. The state is responsible for that. And so that's coming up. There's an issue about right now the machine is, you know, basically belongs to the contractor. But there's a point at which, when the machine is proven, it becomes the state's machine. That's coming up. And if there's a problem with the machine, if the machine itself is the problem, and that is a distinct possibility here, WSDOT is going to want that machine fixed or replaced or rebuilt or...
How do you get it out?
How do you back it up? Is exactly, you have to back it up and send the other guy in.
You can't back it up.
You have
to get it out somehow.
How do you get it out?
No, it's a one-way machine, Marcy.
Yeah, this is something that came up. This is something that the Stranger raised, actually, when, you know, the Stranger was raising a lot of concerns, including that things could go wrong and it could be very expensive, and everyone was saying, you're just naysaying, and people were mad at Mike McGinn for being an obstructionist. And one of the points that was made was, you can't back this thing up. That's not a great idea.
So one of the interesting developments this week is that WSDOT has assembled a team of tunnel experts, including people from other parts of the world, who are coming in here to take a look at what's going on. That suggests big problem, not small problem.
Those are Bertha whisperers is what they are.
Bertha whisperers. There you go.
Well, new Seattle Mayor Ed Murray was in our studio on Monday. And one thing that he said to me, and I don't know if he was serious or not, was that he thought, I asked who should pay for it, and he sort of hemmed around that. But then he said he thought the city should take over management of this project.
I hadn't heard that.
I hadn't heard that.
Well, he told me, I've got it on recording.
Well, you know.
Seems like the last thing that a new mayor would want to take control of.
Well, if he has an answer for it, then it's worth taking control of it. But, you know, he was down there when the whole, and he was transportation oriented when all of this was taking shape, and that funny language we talked about last week was put into the legislation about if there are cost overruns beyond $2.8 billion, then it'll be Seattle area property owners who benefit from the project, which was everybody always thought, what on earth does that mean? And so there's that. But I'm surprised that the mayor wants this darling project.
I'm not sure if he wants it. I think he likes to smooth things over. I mean, that's part of his... part of why he got elected.
Yeah. Well, the problem here is that there's no smoothing it over. The Lynn Peterson is saying, look, there's an engineering fix and we'll fix it and we'll get the job done. So she's trying to restore confidence in the overall project so people 1,000 feet in don't, cut and run. And that's probably true. There probably is a fix. The question is, how much is that going to cost? How long will it take? Are we getting into big dig territory?
And who pays for it?
And who pays for it? Those are the issues. And that doesn't we have no reason to be sanguine.
That's a nice way to. Nice place to take a little pause. Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter with me here on The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scherr. This is The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman with our panel of journalists, news analyst Joni Balter, Knute Berger, the Moss back at crosscut.com, and Stranger Associate Editor Eli Sanders. A lot of sibilance in that introduction, Eli. This week, we're leaving state politics a second. Tom Robleski, the head of Local 751 of the International Association of Machinists, said, I don't want this job anymore. It's making me sick physically.
I think it gave him an ulcer.
Yes, he was in the hospital
or
twice.
Or he had an ulcer.
He might have had an ulcer exacerbated by being the head of this union. He had a thankless task.
And was caught, really, really caught between... rock in a hard place, so to speak. His membership did not, like the deal that he was at first defending, it sounded like, if I read correctly, and then stood up at a meeting and ripped the deal in half and said this deal is
a piece of crap.
A piece of crap, thank you. I didn't know if I could what I could say on
it was in the newspaper. You can say it on National Public Radio.
So you can understand. And he was essentially saying my benefits package isn't good enough to be made sick by this job. I'm going.
We had a producer, Hannah Byrne, reach out to some machinists to get them to respond, and here's what they had to say.
I think he was in over his head. But, I'm terribly disappointed that he would leave at this point in time. With all the things that the machinist union membership has gone through over the past few weeks, for him to depart now and leave us in a lurch, it's not good.
He's left us in a spot where we're in a healing mode right now. We're not in a good spot right now. Not a good time to be left.
That's Sarah Baumgarten and David Clay, who are two members of Local 751. Machinists talking about Tom Robleski, the leader of their union, who gave, I believe, 2 weeks' notice. And this, not as Sarah alluded to, this 51-49% vote to approve this contract extension, the narrowest of margins, really split the membership of this group of people.
And you can imagine the stress on him. You were talking about interviewing stress at work.
That's coming up on the record today. You can hear about that.
But you can, and there were times when he was kind of quiet during the holidays and you were wondering what was going on. I didn't know. Who knew that he was in the hospital managing stress or dealing with it anyway.
Well, it brings up that question Sarah in that clip there talked about, you know, we're starting the healing process, but can the machinists move on as a unified group from what happened in December?
Well, there were problems at multiple levels because you had a division between the local and the national union. Debating over whether the vote should take place and whether to support it or not. And then the rank and file was so closely divided on the issue. So that's a big wound because you've basically got half the people on one side and half on the other. That's a big issue. And then you have the issues of the sense of betrayal that some union members have that felt that the political leadership in this state backed Boeing over them. I can see why it would be a healing thing, and it may be good to have somebody fresh in there who can come up, even though that may be difficult.
And then the machinists withdrew their support of Representative Rick Larson, mm-hmm. and I think it had to do with sort of degree of how you spoke before the vote, because you know they didn't go after Jay Inslee, except they had earlier. But they didn't go after him in this same sentence and time and say, we're mad at Jay Inslee. Jay Inslee had called for a vote. He didn't say which way to vote, but some members of the Labor Council were annoyed at him, too, earlier.
Well, there were a lot of local politicians urging a yes vote. They got together, led by Everett Mayor Ray Stephenson, who said, you know, it's imperative for my city and for Pierce County that we keep this work here. Right now we're seeing sort of state infighting over the wing assembly. Will it be in rural Pierce County? Will it be in Snohomish County? Will it be in Spokane County? The work conceivably could go there. So, you know, the pitting of town against town, state against state is now devolved into town against town, county against county.
Just one thing that I heard this week that I thought was interesting was one reason Boeing is so interested in a state transportation package is that Boeing employees travel 8.5 million miles per year on Washington state roads.
That's a stat.
It's not only people commuting to the assembly plants, but it's moving parts and moving big equipment. And that's all over the state. And so they have a great interest in seeing the road infrastructure improved in places like Spokane and Joint Base Lewis-McChord mm-hmm. and other places, precisely because they want to be able to put these operations in different places and make sure that their employees can get to and from work. And I just thought I was astounded at the mileage that the Boeing folks put on the road.
Yeah, but here's what's interesting. When Rodney Tom said that the priorities for the majority coalition caucus are jobs, education, and budget, he did not mention transportation in that little sentence there. Hmm.
Well, that transportation package is still looming. Another couple of interesting smaller stories this week, smaller than Boeing and smaller than the state legislature. The Catholic Archdiocese in Seattle finally actually had to address the ongoing protests from the students from Eastside Catholic High School. It's been an interesting thing. These kids are not backing down. I don't know where poor Mark Zamuda, the former vice principal, is in all of this. But this really, in a larger sense, you look at the Catholic Church and these rules and regulations, and you look at evolving attitudes towards same-sex marriage to just being out and gay in America. And you know, there something has to give. And I don't think it's going to be attitudes on the part of the society.
You actually end up seeing a certain wisdom in the statement from the Pope a while ago where he said, you know, paraphrasing, but pushing gay people out of Catholicism should not be our central focus anymore because it is going to divide the church, older people against younger people. I mean, the generational divide on this issue is so stark. And so it's unfortunate that the Archdiocese in Seattle doesn't get that.
Well, here's something stark. So in the case of these folks who, these employees who are getting married, gay married, the church is in the ironic position of urging divorce.
That is an ironic position.
The other kind of irony is that you can be a gay married mayor of Seattle but you cannot be vice principal or coach at a Catholic school if you're gay and married. And that's where part of the, you know, societal divide just is not going to stand. I mean, Ed Murray is a devout Catholic. Mm-hmm. He attends Mass regularly. He's the epitome of the dilemma that the church has, and he's also, I think, you know, in great degree, a real role model for people.
Somebody said to us on KOW at some point in the last couple of weeks that they thought what was happening with the kids was a real tribute to Catholic school education, that they've been inculcated with these great values that they were now
applying.
Yes, exactly. So it just seems like one of those dogs chasing its tail.
Well, it's just what's happening in public attitude. I had stopped sort of counting the number of states where gay marriage was legal, and then it was sort of eye-popping. It's 17 now. I saw in the story, and all those signatures, and all of this is just, this is the change that's sort of forcing itself forward, and the Catholic schools and church are caught right there. That's the friction line.
But these are, you know, there's Catholic schools and then there's the archdiocesan controlled Catholic schools. So there's even a difference between that, because as I understand it, some schools set their own policy and some that have direct oversight.
I didn't know
by
that.
The archdiocese.
So is this one controlled by the archdiocese?
Yes. So it's somebody who's listening can probably email and explain it to me, because I'm not an expert in parochial school administrative structures. But I've just, you know, it's an interesting thing to watch these kids continue speaking out. And if I were Mark Samuda, I guess I'd feel pretty happy that I made that kind of difference in my school, because the kids clearly love him.
Mm-hmm.
Last but not least, for many people, we have been shouting out at KUOW about that football game thing that's happening on Sunday.
That their football game?
There is a football game. So don't drive down in the stadium district if you want to avoid it. I don't even actually know what time it is, but San Francisco Giants are coming to town. This is the game. Canute, before we talk philosophically about football, you wrote a hilarious thing about being soaked to the skin. It was the worst possible weather last Saturday to sit outside for hours at a football game. But you did it.
It was, yeah. Well, it was just funny. I mean, my son and I went to the game. Yeah, it was funny. It was just because my son and I went to the football game. We parked the car up in the ID. And the second we got out of the car, this monsoon started, and I've been in monsoon weather in Hong Kong and other places, but imagine that's hail blowing with like a 40-mile
sideways
wind.
Right,
it was unbelievable. And of course everybody's umbrella was turned inside out, hats were blowing off, but you were soaked within seconds, even with good gear.
Yeah.
You just got completely soaked and cold, and then you went and you stood for 4 hours in the stadium, because nobody sat the entire game. Everybody stood the entire, you know, cheering the entire game, and you're in this cold, you know, 25-mile-an-hour wind. That's
gosh, that sounds so fun.
Way to sell it.
Yeah, and we had a blast.
Like to buy a
it
ticket?
Was like people were screaming their lungs out, and it was almost as if, in this kind of Shakespearean way, we were calling on the elements to smite our enemies. There was lightning, there was rain, there was wind. It was like, you know, it's the 12th man plus the Northwest.
Well, and it's not going to act out quite in the same way. But you said it was one of the best experiences at a football game you've ever had.
Yeah,
I don't know how many you've had. Maybe you've had two.
No, I've had more.
This one and the other one, you know.
Many more than that. It was just from a fan perspective. Was really great. It was, you know, just the energy in that stadium was. And it reminded me, I mean, you know, the Mariners playoff series against the Yankees in 1995. I mean, there have been these instances in Seattle's past where there have been that kind of intensity and excitement and energy. And this was one of those days.
Well, I've been also interested to read there have been two great smack talk articles, one that you wrote, Canute, and one that columnist Danny Wesneed had splashed over the front page of the Seattle Times. And both of them talk about, if you will, Seattle's sense of self vis-a-vis our glamorous West Coast neighbor to the South. And Knut, you wrote about this and you have told me this as well, that we are the wife, San Francisco is the mistress.
Well, that, you know, Seattle has long wanted to be the dominant city on the Pacific Coast. I mean, our first name was New York. That sort of said it. But the city that we had the most relationship with, it was the only market for a long time for our goods, was San Francisco. We wanted to be San Francisco. And we've paralleled some of their growth with being a gold rush town and everything. But we've always been, yeah, that's the old joke was, you know, Seattle is the wife. Seattle is sensible shoes. You know, San Francisco's the city you leave your heart in, you know. And so we've always sort of aspired to be. And so there's a way that this game and the rivalry, and of course there are other reasons for the rivalry, but there's a way in which the game is taking place in the context of some interesting history.
And also it has inspired great SmackDown talk. And so Prince of SmackDown, Luke Burbank, host of LiveWire, joins us.
A new name for you.
You're in Chicago, I believe.
I am.
You're not?
Yeah, I was doing Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me this week.
Ah. Well, will you be back with that white shirt that you were telling us about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wore it on last week, and it was a big hit. I'm actually going to the game this week.
Wearing the white shirt, though.
Wearing the one of the least attractive 1980s Seahawks sweaters you'll ever see.
That's awesome.
We can pick
well, so, Luke, you just heard Knut talking about, you know, our inferiority complex, maybe our historical sense of being less than when it comes to San Francisco. So you, being the man of wit and charm that you are, what do you say when you look at Seattle and San Francisco, your hometown and that one that's down the coast?
Well, okay, I've only been to San Francisco or stayed overnight in San Francisco a handful of times, and I have to admit that one of the times was possibly the worst experience of my life, which was we were driving from Los Angeles up to Seattle. We stopped off to stay with some friends in San Francisco, and they lived in this apartment in a very kind of hip neighborhood of San Francisco, but they had 11 roommates because no one was forced to have their own place, and 10 of the roommates had cats.
Eight of those cats
had urinary tract infections. And they couldn't open the windows in the apartment because there was so much noise in the hip neighborhood of San Francisco. They had to keep the windows closed so you could sleep, which allowed the cat urine to just sort of like create this incredible, incredibly acrid kind of smell. So I can't not think of San Francisco and the cat urine smell when I think of this game. That being said, I actually think that it's important to remember Seattle is an amazing city, and Seattle has an amazing football team this year. When, in years to come, our football team is not as good, Seattle will still be an amazing city. And because there are lots of really bad cities that have great sports teams, and they make the mistake, I think, of combining their sense of the city with the how good their team is. And I point to a city like Dallas. What do you have if the Cowboys aren't winning? You've got Bubkiss. So I want to make sure that we in Seattle remember that we are a great town, whether or not our sports teams are doing well.
Oh, and wise sort of, one. Thank you.
And sort of in that vein, there was another column this morning by someone from the Bay Area who talked about, you know, forget all this smack talk. We're not enemies. We're twin sisters. That, you know, folks in the Bay Area who wouldn't live in the Bay Area maybe would move to Seattle, that we have more in common.
They already have moved to Seattle.
And most of them have moved to Seattle, but that
with
this notion that we really kind of like each other. We have similarities, and so it's not all smack talk. Except for yours, which was.
I'm just envisioning all those cats who theoretically won't be with the fans in CenturyLink.
Well, I mean, we kept them out of the state of Washington, right? I mean, wasn't that one of the other news stories this week?
Yes.
That we're not selling tickets to Californians?
We are not.
Like
no, but they're wily. They're smart. They can find a way to come to a game if they want to. Well, Luke will be at CenturyLink Field in the hideous white shirt, cheering for the Seahawks, I think.
I will be, yes, I'll be the crazed Seahawks fan in the white shirt.
Mumbling about cats.
Just mumbling about cat pee, like you do.
Luke Burbank, host of LiveWire, which you can hear tonight at 8 o'clock on KUOW. Thanks so much, Luke.
Thanks. Go Seahawks.
Go Seahawks, indeed. And I'm still thinking about incontinent cats in an apartment in San Francisco. I lived in that apartment once in San Francisco, I must say. Well, next week, Steve Scher will be back in the seat, but our esteemed panel of journalists will be here as themselves. News analyst Joni Balter, Knut Berger, the Moss back at crosscut.com and editor-at-large for Seattle Magazine, and Eli Sanders, who is associate editor at The Stranger. Always great to have you here.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Martha.
You've been listening to The Week in Review on KUOW.